You're listening to Math and Magic, a production of iHeartRadio.
I knew nothing about house music. I went to a friend here in New York. I said, if I really want to learn about the history of dance music, who can I talk to? And he said, go meet Paul Oakenfold. And then about 5 years ago, Paul was coming to New York to play at Marquee. And he said to me, you know, I hear you're getting pretty good. Why don't you take an hour at Marquee in front of me? I said, Paul, I've never DJed in front of people. How can I possibly do that? And he said, just do it. You'll do fine. I was lost in the moment and it felt great. So I started knocking around New York and doing it. Nobody knew that I was doing it. And then a New York Times reporter heard about it, wrote an article about it. Lloyd Blankfein, former CEO and my mentor, did something that I thought was very cool. The day that it came out, he tweeted out the article and made a joke. He said, sometimes David just has to let his hair down.
I'm Bob Pittman, and welcome to this episode of Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. On this episode, we're going to push the frontiers a bit to banking, Wall Street, and explore the relationship of math and magic there. Our guest today is a man of broad interest and skills. He is the fairly recently appointed chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs, and he is also DeSol, the DJ. He has already put his stamp on Goldman Sachs and the industry in a number of ways, but one of the most interesting and important is in diversity and inclusion. One stat, correct me if I'm wrong here, 2019 summer intern class was 54% women. Not quite the stereotype we have of Wall Street. He also, gasp, relaxed the dress code, signaling a better understanding of the millennial workforce and clients. It's been reported that his favorite Shakespeare quote is, "If music be the food of love, play on." Seems to sum up much of his life. We're going to jump into all this, plus his early days, career lessons he's learned, and also how Goldman Sachs is more than what you may think it is. It's also a major tech company. David Solomon, welcome.
Thank you.
Before we get started, we're going to do you in 60 seconds. Okay, ready?
Mm-hmm.
Do you prefer vanilla or chocolate?
Vanilla.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Facebook or Instagram?
Instagram.
Skiing or yoga?
Skiing.
Red or white wine?
Both.
Sunrise or sunsets?
Sunsets.
I thought you were going to say both because of your working hours. Yankees or Mets?
Yankees.
Giants or Jets?
Jets.
Boats or planes?
I'd like to say both, but I'll say boats. I live on planes, but I really prefer boats.
Yeah, I know that feeling. David Guetta or Avicii?
Avicii.
Aspen or Vail?
Aspen.
It's about to get harder. Secret talent?
Well, a number of years ago, I would have said DJ. Now it's not a secret.
Typical breakfast?
Yogurt, berries.
Favorite city?
New York.
Favorite wine?
Great bottle of red Burgundy from France.
Career highlight?
I think my career highlight had to be when I moved from Bear Stearns to Goldman Sachs in 1999. I mean, that certainly set me up on an interesting course.
It sure did. Childhood hero?
You know, I was a New York kid, Joe Namath.
Broadway Joe.
Broadway Joe.
Mentor?
There was a man that at an early stage of my career, his name was Richie Metric.
Good to give him a shout out. Best live concert?
I'll always go back for a Bruce Springsteen show.
Best thing about being you?
I'm a lucky guy. I mean, the best thing about being me, I've got two beautiful daughters who I love dearly.
Who would play you in a movie?
Bruce Willis.
Oh, that's true. What would the title of your memoir be?
I'd like to say I did it my way.
Great way to end it. Let's get into it. Here you are, CEO of Goldman Sachs, but you were a political science major, correct?
Yes.
At a small liberal arts college, Hamilton, in rural New York. Not exactly what you would think is the training ground for Goldman Sachs CEO. You studied Shakespeare and even spent a month in London studying Shakespeare. You've got no MBA.
That is correct.
You've got no fancy business school.
That is correct.
So what is
generally
it about,
that goes with not having an MBA. I mean,
so what is it about that kind of college education that prepared you for this job and this career?
I've thought about it a lot recently, Bob, is that how did I wind up here? Finance and Wall Street has changed a lot over the course of the 35 plus years since I got out of college. I got out of college in 1984, and Wall Street was really just evolving, developing. The markets were very localized, and I really stumbled into finance because I was coming to New York. All my college buddies were coming to New York, and I was looking for a job. There wasn't a preset plan, and one of the things I'd observed that is different today, young people, while they're studying in college, they're so programmed to think they have to have an answer. They have to have a plan. I worked at a summer camp all through my college years, finance, like any other business, is about how people interact with people. To be successful in finance, you can do it by being a mathematician and being very quantitative and being very analytical, but you can also do it by being very good in connecting with people and giving advice and consulting and counseling. I fell more into the latter category than the former.
Do you think there's something in your college education that you got out of being in this small college in this rural setting that gave you some insight which has propelled you in ways you might not have had?
I think the education I got at Hamilton was extraordinary. And if I were to talk about two really base principles in a Hamilton College education that I think helped me and really made a difference, it's communication skills. It's public speaking and written communication, oral and written communication. And really at Hamilton, even to this day, there are almost no requirements in terms of what you take other than you take public speaking and you take a freshman English writing class. And I think when you get out into the world, the ability to communicate is super important.
Do you find in people coming out of school that they are lacking that ability to communicate through writing?
I think, unfortunately, one of the things technology has done is it's changed to a great degree the way young people, as they're educated, even at the highest standards of education, are writing. I think that's unfortunate, and I think it's a lost skill, and I think it will impact our society in interesting ways over time. I like to say that text is the lowest form of human communication. That doesn't mean it's not effective for certain things, but there's no context, there's no nuance, there's no substance around it. It's not going away, but I think there's something that's getting lost.
So let's go back a little farther to get some more insights. You grew up north of New York City, New York suburbs. What did your mom and dad do for work?
My mom was an audiologist. My mom actually would have been a doctor if she could have had her way, but she graduated from Cornell in 1960. And, you know, at that point in time, there weren't a lot of women that were heading to medical school. So she ultimately studied audiology. She had an audiology practice up in Westchester at the Burke Rehabilitation Hospital, built a private practice and had a nice business in that. I was the oldest of three. As my youngest brother got more into his school years, my mother devoted more time to that. My father, for a significant part of his career, owned a printing business, a small financial printing business in the city with a partner. They were very smart in that they sold it at exactly the right time, probably around 2000, just as that whole business really went away.
So did your mother ever warn you about listening to the music too loudly?
She absolutely did. In fact, I do, when I go into clubs now or on plane, I do have high quality earplugs.
Your graduating class in high school, I believe, was about 125 students.
You've done a lot of research, Bob. I am very, very impressed.
And you had a job, as you say, as a camp counselor. I think you were scooping ice cream, too, was one of your jobs.
Yeah, that was actually my first real job, as I worked at the Baskin-Robbins in Hartsdale, New York.
And your high school quotes were very earthy. Emerson, the success of a job well done is to have done it. Thoreau, what a man thinks of himself. That is what determines, or rather indicates, his life.
You'd call those earthy?
Those are earthy. I think it's sort of really in touch with yourself. Is that always been a hallmark of yours, or is that because you were in this environment? What do you think?
My parents definitely encouraged us to pursue passions, to have self-confidence, and to be willing to fail. And, you know, when you do fail, which invariably you will, pick yourself up, dust yourself off. I would say there was some sense of trying to think big picture as to what really matters to me. I want to try. I want to do my best. I want to feel good about myself. You know, it seemed more relevant than something like "We Are the Champions" from Queen, which sat in a lot of those yearbook quotes at that point in time.
So you then, looking at you now, what do you think you then would say?
I just can't imagine that at 18 years old, I could have seen myself having gone to finance, to Wall Street, having worked there pretty much continuously for 35 years without interruption and winding up in this seat. I think myself then would say, wow, how did that happen? I was a good student. I wasn't a great student. I played sports. I was involved in student government. You know, I was involved in the musical production, you know, at school. I was very active in school. I loved my community. I had a great, great high school experience. This is definitely a different outcome than I think 18-year-old David would have imagined.
Math and magic is about marketing. And one of the key pieces of marketing is brand, maybe the most important piece. You've got one of the, if not the best brand on Wall Street. How do you describe that brand? What is Goldman Sachs?
Goldman Sachs has always been an institutional firm. This year, we're celebrating 150 years, which is really extraordinary. There aren't a lot of companies that make it through that time period. for the vast majority of our time, we served governments, corporations, and institutions. It's been an institutional firm. And for those clients, I think our brand has symbolized excellence, really high quality people that are able to give advice at the highest level. It's symbolized a collaborative environment, a team orientation, which helps people solve their problems. And that's been very, very effective for us. I think the interesting thing for us now is that we're starting to build consumer brands. That's a very, very different thing. And so as I think about Goldman Sachs as a consumer company or a company that's serving consumers with a variety of products, I want to think about human interaction first. I want us to be a financial services where the quality of the human interaction is real, it's personal, and it matters, even though it's going to be enhanced by technology in a digital age. I want people to feel that the experience has the same level of excellence in everything we do that people might see if they were dealing with us institutionally. And last, the things we're trying to build around our brand, we want them to be centered around our clients, around the individuals. So the experience that you'll get will be one that's really centered around you. And so we're trying to think about that as we're building these digitally enhanced businesses and trying to move into competing in these consumer businesses. But it's forcing us to wrestle a little with how do we want to define our brand? Because certainly you define a consumer brand differently than you define an institutional brand.
B2B brand.
And that's new for us. And so we're thinking about that.
Who is the steward of the brand?
The 38,000 employees of Goldman Sachs. One of the things that I feel so incredibly lucky is that I work with 38,000 people around the world who are really extraordinary. It's an extraordinary organization with extraordinary people. And every single one of those people is an ambassador of our brand, of our values, of what we strive for. With any business, you can have 38,000 people rowing the boat in the same direction, but if you have one person who kind of stands up and does something that's not appropriate, doesn't match with our values, you know, it really attacks the brand. And so I want to applaud, you know, all the people who work in an organization that really steward the brand, and I want us all to be zealous to protect it.
As we examine these case studies, one of the things that jumps out is that the culture so influences the brand. Going to your point about everybody's rowing in the same direction. If you got the culture going the right way, the brand naturally moves the right direction. What do you do to build the culture that perpetuates that brand?
Culture is built over time. And it's one of the things that I spend a lot of time thinking about because we have some very, very large companies that have been around for 20 years or less. And no matter how you think about that, the culture of those companies can't be that rooted in foundation because it's really new. It's developing. I think culture has to start with the leadership, and the leadership can't just espouse it. They have to live it. I think you have to decide what you stand for, and there are times when you've got to stand up for those things and make choices that are more investing in the long-term foundation of the organization than the short-term benefit of the organization. We think a lot about teamwork and collaboration. We think a lot about excellence. We think a lot about creativity and innovation, and we think a lot about diversity and inclusion. Those things create an environment that people want to be a part of.
Culture is the operating system.
Absolutely.
If you don't get that right, none of the programs work very well on a corrupted operating system.
It's a great way to look at it. And you always are going to be challenged and tested because these are big organizations and there are a lot of people and things go wrong. That's part of running big, complicated businesses. But the culture gets stronger by how you respond when things go wrong and how you endorse what you think is right or wrong for the organization over a longer period of time.
And what do you think are threats to the brand? Do you see any on the horizon or do you see them in the day-to-day operation of the company?
Well, I think that if we serve our clients well, if we serve our clients and now our customers well with a medium or long-term view, if we do the right thing for the long term, we'll do just fine as an organization. Our brand is very susceptible because of the visibility of the company. Any mistakes that we make get amplified. Those things hurt our brand and they can nag at the organization a little bit. I worry about that, you know, every single day.
You've been very good, and I think the company has, about responding to those very quickly. Do you have a system of doing it? Do you have a, this is the way we're going to handle it. When something goes wrong, we're going to, what?
We're talking about some of this stuff that I think really is about how the leadership at the top of the organization responds. And I'll start by saying, I'm a relatively new leader. It's been less than a year in the seat, but I'm a big believer in when there are issues, transparency, clear message, accountability.
Let me go on a tangent for a second.
Sure.
You said Goldman Sachs has about 40,000 employees. I think about 11,000 of those are engineers or tech people.
That's correct, about 11,000
engineers. So about a quarter of your employees are tech. And I don't think a lot of people think of Goldman Sachs as a tech company. You clearly are when you invest that much. Why is technology so key to what you do?
Well, let's just step back at a high level. Can you name a company that today does not use technology in a significant way to connect with their customers or their clients, to deliver their products or services, to enhance the capabilities of their talent and their human capital to serve, you know, in their business? Every single company in the world is using software and platforms to make them more efficient or better do or deliver what they're doing. Look at your business. And so in the context of that, of course, we're a technology company, but we're not really a technology company. We're a company that's providing products and services to people, mostly financial products and financial services. And we use technology to enhance our ability to deliver that in the most effective way possible. Think about the trading businesses. These were businesses, if you go back 30 years ago and you wanted to trade all different kinds of securities, it was person to person, mostly over the counter. Today, a lot more of that is done through platforms, and we connect through pipes that run between clients directly to us. And so having the best technology that allows the greatest efficiency and speed with the least friction is important in this business as it is in any other.
So technology for your business, like ours, is an enabler.
It's an enabler. It's a necessity,
right,
that you use it to enable or you can't compete.
Right.
Yeah.
So having that many tech people, though, in this company that was once bankers and traders, et cetera, how does that influence the culture?
It's evolving. And when you highlighted that we formally changed the dress code, you know, you talked about it as a reaction to millennials. It also was a reaction to the fact that 25% of our organization was engineers. And so one of the things I did when I walked in at the beginning of my tenure as CEO, you've been in our building, there's a sky lobby, you go up 11 floors. It's where the organization gathers. There are hundreds of people milling around on a given day. There's a Starbucks in the sky lobby. And I kind of walked in and looked around, and everybody was dressed casually. And of course, I was in my suit, and everybody was dressed casually. And I kind of looked around and I said, okay, I wonder, do we actually have a dress code? What does that dress code look like? Has anybody looked at it in a number of years? So I promptly marched upstairs to my office and said, can somebody get me the dress code? And this 35-page document arrives. That had
your dress code was 35 pages.
It was every department and every division had a different dress code. And it was literally, I'm not exaggerating, 35 pages. And I looked at this and I said, you know what? It's time to modernize. And we put out a very simple note saying, dress in a way that's appropriate for your day, for the clients you're seeing or the people you're interacting with, dress in a way that's appropriate. We run an organization that's filled with adults. People know what's appropriate and what's not. If people see something that's inappropriate, they're going to say something. And it was really endorsing what had already happened, but the organization had moved there because of the diversity of our organization. And this was an endorsement or an acknowledgement of that. In the context of the decisions I've had to make in the last year, this was one of the easy ones.
You hire about 2,500 people out of school each year, I think. It's got to be tough to keep it up to be the first choice of people who want to come to you. How does this cultural stuff you're talking about affect that when they look at Goldman Sachs?
We're very fortunate that we've managed over a long period of time with a lot of investment to be a very desirable place for people to come to work out of college. We get tens and tens of thousands of applications for those jobs. And actually, the number of applications has been increasing. I think the firm, through its training programs, through its brand, through the experience that people have at the organization, and also the experiences people have when they leave, you know, is very well positioned as a great place to start to build a career. And there are people that come and they stay for 25 years. And there are people that come and they spend a couple of years and they learn and they meet people and they start to create a network. And then they're exposed to other things and they decide, I want to go do something completely different. It's a good ecosystem. And so we work really, really hard to try to maintain that.
Just hold on a second, because we've got so much more to talk about. We'll be back after a quick break. Welcome back to Math and Magic. We're here with David Solomon. We have folks who do great research here. And as I was digging through the reams of information which was compiled here, a couple of things jumped out at me. 74% of your workforce is millennials. 60% are under the age of 30.
That's correct.
That's not the image of Goldman Sachs. And the culture you're talking about clearly sounds like it's reflective of that. You've made some big workplace changes to prevent burnout, to improve the work experience, sounding like also being responsive to this new generation. Can you talk a little bit about that besides the dress code and some of the other stuff we've covered?
Sure. And your comment, it's very interesting. It's not the image of Goldman Sachs. One of the things I'm wrestling with is Goldman Sachs was a private partnership for 130 years, and it became a public company 20 years ago. You know, it became a public company at a time where finance was growing wildly. So really, for the first 140 years of Goldman Sachs didn't talk about itself. It didn't advertise. It didn't. It was a very private place. You wake up today, Goldman Sachs is a Fortune 50 company, and we need to communicate a little bit more about who we are. We're a young organization for exactly what I said. It's an experience-based business, but we start by hiring a lot of people at a young age. It's definitely a young organization. The way we work is changing. And because the way we work is changing, some of the old ways that people did things, you know, needed to change. And so it is an apprenticeship business. And at times in apprenticeship businesses, there's a little bit of, I did it this way. I was trained this way. So you're going to live through the same thing. We wanted to try to break that up. And the way I think about it is very simple. When I was young and I was working in the business, I worked very, very hard. There were nights where I worked all night and I worked very, very hard. But one thing was clear. When I walked out of the office, no matter what time I walked out of the office, I was out, I was gone, and I was disconnected. The only way you could reach me, and this was 1984, was to call my home number. If I wasn't there, an answering machine picked up. If I was there, often an answering machine picked up because I was screening the calls. So you were really unreachable. There were boundaries, and people could not get in touch with you, and it wasn't unusual that people, if something came up, they couldn't get to you to the next day. And so you look at the world today, we're all connected instantly. For someone who's young and is coming out of school and they're just making the transition to going into a professional work environment, and you're in a client business where stuff's coming at you at all time, we just decided we had to set up boundaries. Nothing comes without hard work, and you need to work hard and you need to be committed, but it can't be 24/7. There have to be boundaries.
How did you set those?
We started by saying, what is a lot of work, but not crazy? And we came to the conclusion for a young person coming out of school, going into finance, that 70 hours a week was a good base. When you got above that, it was just too much.
Danger zone.
The quality went down. So the first thing we did is we decided we were going to track how people were working. People go in and out of the building. You can get a rough idea of when people are in the building. You know, what we saw was there was a giant bell curve. The myth was everybody was out on one end working 100 hours a week. The reality was, the bell curve was generally where you wanted it to be, 60 to 70 hours a week, but there were outliers on both sides. We started managing the outliers directly because we had the data. And the other thing we did, we said, let's set up some boundaries. If people are going to work this way, there's plenty of time to get the work done. Let's close the shop from 9 o'clock on Friday night and 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. We're just going to close the shop. You have your Friday night, your Saturday night, and you have your Saturday, and you can make plans with a girlfriend or a boyfriend, with your family. It changes your mindset. And so when we put it forward, oh, people are yelling and screaming, this could never work. This is crazy. It hasn't been perfect, but it's set boundaries and it's helped. And the feedback I get from young people in the organization is it's made a difference.
You talked about diversity and inclusion. I know you. I know this has been very important to you. You mentioned up front, we talked about the summer interns. 54% of summer interns were women. One of your first moves as CEO, I thought was very interesting. You added 4 new members to the executive management committee, 3 of whom were women. Impressive actions. What is your plan? I mean, that's clearly part of an overall plan. How are you thinking about it?
You know, diversity and inclusion, I just think, is something that any world-class organization has to make a priority. When I look at our industry and our organizations, we've probably made more progress than certain other industries because we've been at it for a period of time, but it's not been enough, and it hasn't gone fast enough, and it hasn't gone far enough. It's got to start from leadership at the top. We tried to solve some of these problems around recruiting by saying, if you're recruiting out of school, schools are diverse, you're really recruiting out of a diverse population, it is unacceptable to recruit out of undergraduate school and not have a diverse outcome. And we got different results. You know, an example of that very specifically was in the investment banking division, and they get tens of thousands of applications. But let's say at the end of the day, we're talking about gender diversity, they get 12,000 super qualified applications, 8,000 are men, 4,000 are women. That division's hiring 350 people. Well, let's get the 175 best women out of the 4,000 women, and let's get the 175 best men. And if you change the mindset to that, you get a great result. You get a more diverse population, and then over time, things improve. From a senior perspective, you've got to take actions that the organization sees and reflects. So I didn't feel our management committee had enough diversity on it. And so I said, you know what? I'm going to look through a different lens. Who are the three or four most important women at the firm that are in big jobs, having a huge impact with our clients, with our business, that aren't on the management committee because they're just not in one of these jobs that have traditionally been the jobs we put on the management committee? And I said, you know what? We're going to change the mix. We're going to send a message that says we want to move faster on this and we care. And so we made those decisions. I made some personnel decisions. I took a woman named Beth Hammack, who was a trader in our securities division. I said, you know what? She'd be a great treasurer of the firm, and that can set her up for bigger jobs. And we plucked her out of a trading seat and made her treasurer of the firm. It's elevated her organizationally, where she now can be seen by the organization more broadly and differently. Stephanie Cohn is a woman who came out of investment banking, is now our head of strategy. And so I've tried to find places where I can try to accelerate some people, make some very conscious choices. Look, it's not perfect, and I'm sure I haven't made all the right ones, but I'm trying to send a message that this matters to me, it matters to the senior leadership of the organization, and we're going to make progress with gender, we're going to make progress with people of color, we're going to make progress with respect to the openness and the inclusion of the organization broadly for everyone, because I think it's a stronger organization, our clients want it, we want it.
Let's turn to the other side of you, DJ Saul. Club DJ.
D-Sol, if you don't mind.
D-Sol, I'm sorry. And you played with some of the great DJs at top venues around the world. In addition to DJ sets and remixes, you've produced one original song, which hit number 4 on the Billboard dance charts. It's sort of impressive. How did you go down this path? How, why, and when?
The big picture story is I've always loved music. You know, as music digitized, you know, I got more interested in curating music. I spent a lot of time in my banking career in and around Las Vegas. I was very involved in financing the development of a lot of the big buildings, entrepreneurs that were out there. About 8 to 10 years ago, it was around the time that the Encore was opening. I was in a meeting where I heard that Tryst, which was the club at the Wynn at the time, was going to make a monstrous amount of money in a given year. And I started asking questions. How is that possible? What is going on that a nightclub could make that kind of money playing recorded music? I was told, well, you know, we're paying the DJs hundreds of thousands of dollars a night, and here's the economics. And I looked at this and I was like, wow, what's going on? So I knew nothing about house music or electronic dance music, you know, at that point. This is when that genre was really, you know, starting emerging. To expand. It was emerging in a broader way. And so I was out there a handful of times, and I went into some of these clubs to try to understand the business model, but I loved the music. I mean, I just really, oh, wow, I like this music. I have to add this. And so I started looking at it, exploring it. I went to a friend here in New York that knows something about the music business. I said, if I really want to learn about the history of house music and dance music, who can I talk to? How can I learn? And he said, go meet Paul Oakenfold. I was out in Los Angeles, and, you know, I sat down with Paul, and Paul's really one of the grandfathers of all this, you know, going back 30 years ago to Ibiza, et cetera. You know, he's roughly my age, and we just kind of hit it off. We had a great conversation, and he was like, well, if you like this, I'll send you some music, and you should play around. You should learn to DJ. Go buy yourself some decks, and they'll talk you through how you can do this as a hobby for fun. I started doing it on Sunday afternoons, and as I got more interested, I hired somebody here who was a professional DJ in New York to come to my apartment on Sunday afternoons and teach me how to mix music, and I was doing it. I was having a good time in my apartment. And then about 5 years ago, Paul was coming to New York to play at Marquee, and he said to me, you know, I hear you're getting pretty good. Why don't you take an hour at Marquee in front of me, in front of the guy who's opening for me? I said, Paul, I've never DJed in front of people. How can I possibly do that? And he said, just do it. You'll do fine. And he said, by the way, it'll be 11 o'clock. There won't be anybody there. So I went in. I did it at 11 o'clock. My kids and some of their friends were there. That was kind of it. But by the time 12 o'clock was around, there were a lot of people there, and I just loved it. I was lost in the moment, and it felt great. So I started knocking around New York and doing it. Nobody knew that I was doing it. I was just doing it for fun in some pretty dingy, dark places. And then a few years ago, the New York Times reporter heard about it, wrote an article about it. And at that point, I kind of had an aha moment where I said, okay, now if I'm going to do this, I actually have to get really good at this, and I've got to really do it, or I've got to stop doing it. And I decided to do it. And one of the things I decided when I decided I would do this, if I started making any money from this, all the money would be directed to charities. And so I've created a small record label that at the moment has two releases on it. I'm hoping over time it will have more, called Payback Records. Any money that comes from the music I produce, or hopefully one day I can get some other artists to maybe put some tracks out on Payback Records, all the proceeds will go to addiction charities. And so try to take what's a hobby and something that I'm very passionate about. I'm just in a very lucky position to have this platform, and try to see if we can do some good with it. And I could be playing golf on a Sunday afternoon, but candidly, I'd rather be in the music studio.
So you're thinking about it as a hobby, but it must have some impact on you as the CEO. What have you learned there that comes out of that side of your personality, your life, that does give you some interesting insights?
Look, I've learned a lot, candidly. I've learned a lot about myself, and I've learned a lot about what it means to be a CEO and be visible and be exposed. When it first was made publicly visible, Lloyd Blankfein, former CEO and my mentor, you know, in the context of my moving along in the organization, did something that I thought was very cool. The day that it came out, he kind of tweeted out the article and made a joke, you know, a nice joke. He said, sometimes David just has to let his hair down. And, you know, it was really, really nice. But he basically said, you know what, this is something he's doing that he's passionate about. It's okay. He endorsed it in a positive way. I really appreciated that. But it also relaxed me and said, okay, if this is kind of who I am or something I'm interested in, be open about it. And the thing that's really surprised me is, by being open and authentic about something that I'm interested in, that makes me the normal person that I am with everybody else, people are more inclined to engage you, to talk to you. It makes you more approachable. I feel like I've learned a lot about what it means to be a leader, to open up, to expose yourself, to be a little bit vulnerable about who you are and what you are. And I think it's good for me as a leader. I think it's good for the organization. Hopefully others feel like they can bring their whole self, their authentic self, to our workplace. I think that's a pretty good thing.
It softens your image as the CEO. As soon as someone sort of knows that about you, you can't be that big bear, terrible CEO sitting in the corner office.
I think you're right about that. I think when people have more insight into who we are, the more open to approaching. And look, I was a senior person at Goldman Sachs for a lot of years.
Right.
Before I was a CEO, I ran investment banking for 10 years. And I just noticed that more people come talk to me today in the hall, in the elevator, and often they approach me to talk about music. It very quickly turns to business or Goldman Sachs. But, you know, that didn't go on the same way before this.
Right. You had this interesting career trajectory. You started Irving Trust. You were Drexel Burnham in their heyday. You did a quick stint at Solomon Brothers. And you were a real star at Bear Stearns. You took a step back to join Goldman Sachs. And here you are today as the CEO. If someone's listening now, and they're sort of looking to you for a little career advice here, what lessons come out of that for someone who's really building a career in finance?
The best piece of advice I ever received was from my grandmother, who, when I was very young, just starting my career, said, don't be in a hurry. I think one of the things that's happening today is everybody is in a hurry to know where they're going. Do they know the destination, instead of kind of enjoying the journey? My career was a journey. I interviewed at Goldman Sachs when I got out of college. I didn't get a job. I interviewed at Goldman Sachs again when I was a couple of years out of college. I didn't get a job. So I never imagined I'd wind up there, but it's a journey and you don't really know where it's going to take you. And part of it is enjoying the ride, not being in a hurry to find out what the destination is.
So with that in mind, thinking about other destinations, you were had a spectacular career in investment banking. You knew every CEO in America. And I know a lot of people tried to hire you to come to businesses. Were you ever tempted to step out of finance and go run a business?
There's no question that somewhere along the way, the thought of having the opportunity to run a business was appealing to me. I never expected it would be Goldman Sachs. Up until right before I got the job, I didn't think I was getting the job. When I was promoted to co-president of the firm, Lloyd said to me, you know what? You're behind. Okay. So I never had an expectation. There was no expectation put upon me. And so as a result, I did what I thought was right, but I always was open to the fact that probably one day I wouldn't get the next job and I'd have to go find something else. And so I listened to a lot of those things, but none of them, as they came through, was more compelling than doing what I was doing at Goldman Sachs. I never looked at it through the lens of what's next. I always looked at it through, is this more compelling right now than what I'm doing? And they just weren't.
You were talking about that you're getting out of shape as you get older, blah, blah, blah. But you do bike, run, ski, golf, kite surf, scuba dive, hike, do yoga. You are in a very high stress job. Do you think these activities counteract that stress? How do you design your life with some kind of balance there so this job doesn't literally kill you?
Look, I think we all have a responsibility to take care of ourselves. I think that's super, super important. For me, the exercise or the activity definitely helps me with stress, helps me think. And so I've incorporated it into my life in a very formal way. I get up every morning, Monday through Friday, and I get some form of exercise. It can be working out with a trainer. It can be going to spin class or riding on a Peloton. This morning, I was out walking very, very briskly uphill on a treadmill for 45 minutes. But I'm doing something because I just need it. When I'm traveling in a way where I miss it for some reason, I find that it does affect, you know, my headspace. And so I think it's very important. And then on the weekends, I try to do the things that are more active, you know, road bike during the summer. I like to kite surf. I like to be in the water. You know, try to stay active. It's not always easy, but I think it's important.
We were talking about culture. Do you build that into the culture or into the organization at all at Goldman Sachs for all the people?
I think you've got a responsibility to make time to take care of your mental and physical health. And I just think you'll be more successful professionally over the medium and the long term if you do that. I'm trying to encourage it the best I can. And hopefully what resonates with people, and it's a choice people have to make. You can't tell people what to do. People have to make a choice.
You're a relatively young CEO for a company like this, and you've just begun. But have you set any parameters for how long you stay in a job like this? How long's the CEO thing last?
It lasts until you and the board decide it's time for somebody. It's time for somebody else. And by the way, it's interesting you say that I'm young. I'm 57. I'll be 58 this year. Lloyd started this job at 51.
I didn't realize
that. Yeah, I actually think, not just for this job, but, you know, generally, I think to start with CEO tenure at 57, it's somewhere between the average and the older side of, I think, when a lot of these jobs
maybe I'm start. Rationalizing because you're a young man to me.
But only by a little.
We always wrap up the show with one last question. Math and Magic is about the special relationship of the analytics of marketing, the math, and the creativity to those insights, how we use them to inspire, attract, or motivate consumers. So if you think about it, in your career, you've seen a lot of really strong analytical people. Is there someone who jumps out at you that we want to give a shout out to as the greatest mathematician you've seen?
I've been blessed to work with so many people that are so extraordinary quantitatively. Their ability to think quantitatively, to analyze, their nimbleness around numbers and facts. It's one of the great things about Goldman Sachs. There are hundreds. And so, you know, to shout one out feels almost impossible to me.
So let's go the other side. Mm-hmm. We take those analytics and we do something with it to cause people to do something. That's the magician. Do you have any magicians you want to give a shout out to that just managed to take that idea and create something? Go, where did they think of that idea?
There are lots of great creative people in the world, but I'm going to answer your question very literally. I look at the great magicians in the world. I look at somebody like David Copperfield. You know, I've spent a little bit of time around magic and small scale illusion. My father used to play around with it a little bit, so I understand some of the base principles, but you look at some of the things that they do and the creativity that goes into creating those experiences, it is magic. It is really crazy.
Literally, the magician.
Literally.
David Solomon, thanks.
Thank you, Bob. Really nice to be here with you.
Here are three things I picked up from my conversation with David Solomon. 1, communication matters. David says the classes that best prepared him for the workforce were public speaking and writing, which helped him communicate ideas clearly and with nuance. 2, you can make quick steps to change corporate culture, from relaxing the dress code to closing the office on Saturdays to prioritizing diversity and inclusion. David has quickly shifted the way his employees think about work. 3, let your hair down. As a leader, people can be intimidated. While David was initially secretive about his interest in electronic music, being vocal about his interest has made him much more approachable to his employees. I'm Bob Pittman. Thanks for listening.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks so much for listening to Math and Magic, a production of iHeartRadio. The show is hosted by Bob Pittman. Special thanks to Sue Schillinger for booking and wrangling our wonderful talent, which is no small feat. Nikki Etor for pulling research, Bill Plax and Michael Azar for their recording help, our editor Ryan Murdoch, and of course, Gail, Raul, Eric, Angel, Noel, Mango, and everyone who helped bring this show to your ears. Until next time.